Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on the Heritage Radio Network. Today, we are sponsored by Dixon's Farmstand Meats, a great butcher shop in Chelsea Market in New York City. And as usual, we're sitting in the back of Roberta's Pizza and Restaurant. We'd like to thank them for having us, hosting us here. And it is springtime here in New York, early springtime, so that means it's time for Easter and, of course, Passover. And today I thought we would talk about the origins and significance of Jewish holiday foods. So, and our guest is Jane Cohen. Welcome, Jane.
Thanks, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jane is the author, most recently, of Jewish Holiday Cooking, which is a wonderful book, a compendium, really, of Jewish holiday foods, and we'll get into that later. And she's also the author of The Gefilte Variations, which is how I first came across her. She did a presentation for Culinary Historians of New York talking about 101 variations of gefilte fish. Hard to imagine. Maybe not 101, but a nice takeoff on the Bach variations. And Jane is an author who writes about food for many different magazines and newspapers. And for this book, The Jewish Holiday Cooking, you, Jane, have become part sleuth, part historian, part, I don't know what else, but you really dug into the depths of a lot of different cultures and countries to find some of the roots and origins of the foods. And what I loved is in the introduction to your book, you pose the notion that Jewish cooking is perhaps the original regional cuisine with a purview that nearly spans the globe. And I think it's such a wonderful way for us to begin our discussion, but for people to understand the history of Jewish cuisine. Is there a Jewish cuisine? And what is Jewish cuisine?
Well, Jewish cuisine actually is not only kosher cuisine. I mean, it would have to respond to all of the kosher precepts, but it also responds to many specific needs that Jews had for holiday cooking. And during the diaspora, when Jews were expelled and wandered in many different homelands all over the globe, they picked up many of the foods that they encountered there and many of the cooking techniques, and they naturalized them. A very good example is potato latkes, potato pancakes. Jews made food that was fried in oil to celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah. And originally, the little pancakes that they made were probably made out of cheese or some type of grain. And eventually, living in Eastern Europe, when potatoes came to that area of the world, sometime in the 18th century, Jews thought that that would be a wonderful way to make latkes, pancakes. And so potato latkes became part of the Jewish repertory.
Interesting. And the fact that there are, of course, different sectors of the world. We have the Ashkenazi Jewish people,
right,
and then the Sephardic. So the foods, I would imagine, are very different. Well, and you describe that. I mean, I'm saying they, I know they are from your book.
A very good example of that, since we're talking about Passover, is the fruit and nut paste called charoset that's used on the Seder plate. if you look at the various recipes for haroset, it's like an international directory of people. Hmm. You have recipes for haroset that include coconut from Suriname, chestnuts from Padova in Italy, oranges and apricots from the Middle East. When people started making haroset in America, they added pecans, an American food, cranberries. And you see this with Jewish food, that it's constantly evolving. People have an idea that it's sort of this culinary dinosaur and the recipes should be set in stone. And when they're talking about that, they're, of course, talking about the kinds of food that their grandmothers made. But
or bubbe cooking, as you
right, or if you're or nona cooking, if you are Italian Jewish,
yes.
You know, and I think it's important for people to put their own stamp on the recipes.
That's
to
very
own
interesting.
Them.
Yeah, well, that's and you do such a beautiful job in the book with creative recipes and new recipes, and also incorporating a lot of the traditional recipes, and I think that's wonderful. What are some of the dishes that have become, well, how did some of the dishes become standardized because they came from so many different places? Talk about maybe some of the dishes that are the oldest dishes that have become, and what are their backgrounds that have become sort of traditional, let's talk about Passover since that's where we are, traditional Passover fare. What would you say were some of the oldest, most historic dishes?
Well, a dish that's a Middle European dish that we very much associate with Passover, that Ashkenazi Jews associate with Passover, is matzah balls.
Mm-hmm.
This really came from the Central European tradition of making dumplings out of either bread or flour. And Jews became very fond of these dumplings. And when it came time to celebrate Passover, and they were not permitted to eat bread or any dishes made out of flour except for matzah or matzah meal, they created matzah balls, which would be a dumpling that would satisfy the requirements of Passover. Another thing is the bitter herb that is eaten on the Seder plate.
Mm-hmm.
In traditional times, the bitter herb was something like sorrel or purslane, wild herbs that were gathered wild in Israel and the surrounding lands. Jews in Eastern Europe found the horseradish would be a perfect substitute because it's bitter. There was some controversy because it has no bitter leaves, and it's supposed to be made out of bitter leaves. But sometime in the Middle Ages, that was accepted as a bitter herb.
Interesting, because that really has held its place on the Seder plate.
It has. Of course, Sephardic Jews do not use horseradish. They'll use something like arugula, sorrel, romaine, celery leaves.
Something that would be Middle East or Mediterranean, more Mediterranean type.
Right, and the salt, instead of using salt water to dip the green vegetable in, Sephardics dip it into vinegar. Mm-hmm. The salt water and the vinegar both symbolize the tears.
Tears, yes. And that's nice to talk about. Maybe some of our listeners aren't aware of what some of the representations are and the symbolism of the food. So The egg.
Oh, and the egg is a perfect example, Linda, of a food that really has ancient origins. The egg that was that's still used by the Sephardi Jews is something called huevos aminados. You can hear the Spanish in that because this was something that the Spanish Jews always used. These were eggs that were slow roasted on top of a stew, often a Sabbath stew. And when I say slow roasted, I mean overnight, so that the eggs would be buried in onion skins, One Turkish woman that I knew said that she often would add her cigarette ashes to it, that it added flavor. So, but traditionally, it's onion skin. Some people add coffee grinds and a little bit of oil and water, and it's cooked overnight. And by the time you eat it, it has this very unusual kind of creaminess. They're really quite delicious. So that is the roasted egg that Sephardi Jews have on the Seder plate. Ashkenazi Jews usually use an egg that has been hard-boiled and then roasted over an open flame. Mm-hmm. And the egg is, like all things in Jewish tradition, layered with meanings. There is first the symbolism of the temple sacrifice. But of course, eggs are just rife with meanings. There's a symbolism of mourning. There's a symbolism of life and rebirth, optimism.
And the fact that it's circular, so it's
circular,
everlasting life.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you mentioned in your family, you have a different way of serving the egg as well. Your family didn't dip the eggs in the salt water in salt. Have a hard-boiled egg and chopped onions?
Right. Which is actually a traditional Eastern European dish. Many people know it as chopped liver, which is chopped eggs and onions with the addition of liver. But in my family, we would have hard-boiled eggs that were chopped up with onions that were sautéed and raw, and either chicken fat or oil.
Sounds like a full dish. I mean, that sounds good.
There are so many courses in the Passover Seder.
Right. What I like is that, and this comes out in every review that I've read of your book as well, that you really do give the why behind a lot of the traditions, but that you also incorporate Jewish cuisine from many different cultures, international cultures, meaning, and that's like leek croquettes from Rhodes and the stuffed chicken soup from Iran and pineapple coconut milk kugel from Bombay. Mm. I mean, these are just such interesting dishes that I think a lot of Americans certainly don't consider, they don't think about or when they think of a traditional Seder dinner.
The leek is a wonderfully symbolic food, and there's actually a little...
Ancient food as well.
Ancient, it was most likely one of the foods that were eaten by the Israelite slaves. And when the Israelites were wandering in the desert and given manna to eat, it was one of the foods that they complained about that they missed most. And because of that, there's a very interesting and fun ritual that Iranian and Afghani Jews have that's now being sort of adopted by Ashkenazi Jews as well. And that is when the traditional Seder song, Dayenu, which means it would have been enough, is sung. At one point during the song, people take leeks, or if they're too expensive, scallions, and start beating their neighbors. It's something that kids really love.
The kids must
really,
go crazy.
Really love. But, actually, Linda, that's one thing about the Seder. The foods are used not only to tell the story, but they're also used to make it a really fun experience for the children. Mm-hmm. You have things not only like the leeks, but you have a tradition of hiding a piece of the matzah, the afikomen, for kids to find. And until that piece of matzah is found by the kids, the Seder can't go on. You can't finish the meal. You have lots of singing, and the dipping is always a lot of fun.
And everybody partaking and participating in the readings as well, those who are old enough, that makes it a very participatory meal. We're going to talk more about that, and we're going to get into some stories about fish as well when we come back.
Seven symbols that are on the Seder table for tonight, and each symbol is symbolic of our plight, freed from bondage into freedom's brilliant light. Unleavened, it's unleavened, matzah baked by former slaves who were so meek. It's the bread of freedom that all people seek. And we only have to eat it for a week.
It's a night we have. Welcome back to A Taste of the Past. In case you couldn't get it from the song, we're talking about Passover and Seder with Jane Cohen. And what I encourage you all to do, if you want to know what song that was, please contact, we have on our page on the website, there is a section for you to contact us. You can make comments on the show. You can express your interest in having me present another topic that you would like to learn more about. So I encourage you to please make a comment on that section, and then we know you're listening, and we know what you think of what we present. Jane, you were giving a wonderful description of how participatory the Seder is in involving children, particularly in those traditions. And I had mentioned how I liked that you brought in all these international cuisines in your book. And I wanted to show you something because I want to talk about gefilte fish. You wrote the book on gefilte variations. And I ran across, here in New York, there are a couple of, well, there are many restaurants who are offering seders for people who aren't cooking at home. And one Sephardic style seder features foods of Central Asian Jews. And a couple of those dishes would be beaten turnip soup and chicken with dried barberries. Mm. And then we have an Indian chef who is offering Ashkenazi standards. This is Floyd Cardoz at Tabla. And you said you've eaten his matzo balls before. He's offering banana leaf-wrapped fish patties. Well, now, I guess this is his take on gefilte fish, correct?
Right.
You said no table is complete without fish, of course.
Well, fish is always a symbolic food that metaphorically brings to mind good luck and fertility. So it's usually present at most Jewish holiday meals and at the Sabbath. I've done a lot of variations on gefilte fish. My particular favorite is one that I do that combines a white fleshed fish with smoked white fish.
Oh.
And the fish, gefilte fish originally was packed into fish skin and poached or baked.
Well, that's something that I learned, that actually gefilte means
stuffed. Right.
Stuffed fish.
Right.
Or stuffed. Right.
And then eventually it was made as a sort of patty and poached separately in a broth, a fish broth. Now, to make that fish broth can be unbelievably smelly, especially if you think of close quarters in a kitchen. So sometimes I cook it in a fish broth, but more often what I do is I poach it in cabbage leaves. Hmm. I set up a poaching,
which could be smelly too.
Yeah, but not quite
like
the same
broth.
It's a technique that I borrowed really from the Chinese, who poach many of their dumplings
in lettuce leaves and cabbage leaves.
Yeah,
right.
So I form it into balls and I put dill on it, which gives it a lovely scent. And I poach it just until it's cooked through. Many times you see these recipes for gefilte fish and they're cooked, the fish patties are cooked for something like 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And by that time, all the flavor leaches out into the broth.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be this thing that's sat in a jar on a grocery shelf floating in this,
No, but when you talk about innovative recipes that chefs are making, Wolfgang Puck has a recipe for gefilte fish that is made with tarragon, and they're very delicately formed balls.
They're like canals.
Yeah. The egg whites, except they have no cream or dairy products in them. But the eggs are separated, the whites are beaten separately, and they're lovely, really delicious.
Hmm. Interesting. So basically, when you say the variation gefilte variations, it's just different methods of cooking and the many different flavorings that you can give it and ingredients you can put in it.
There is a dish that's not gefilte fish, but very similar in purpose, and that is a North African dish called belahat. And those are made, they're fish balls that are poached in a very flavorful tomato sauce, easy to make and really delicious, hot or cold.
But for gefilte fish, is it, you say a white flesh fish, but I thought it was standard that carp was always used.
Well, what you really need, Linda, is a combination of fatty fish and lean fish. Mm. If you just use lean fish, it'll fall apart and really be kind of insipid tasting. Traditionally, it was made with lake fish, and that is the trinity of carp, whitefish, and pike. Mm. Whitefish is not always easy to get. And certainly in America, many people use river fish or saltwater fish. People use mahi-mahi. Salmon is a very common fish now used for gefilte fish. But you always have to make sure that you will have that combination of fatty and lean fish.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's and other than the gefilte fish, what are there other types of fish that are traditional on
well yes in Greek and Turkish Jewish cooking, they make a marvelous fish that's made with rhubarb. Rhubarb and tomato. I actually
very seasonal too that's
very wonderful. Seasonal yeah. Well, that's a very interesting point, because Jewish holiday food really reflects the rhythm of the seasons. So Passover is a spring holiday, and ideally you should reflect this on your table with wonderful spring vegetables, spring green herbs. Iranian Passover food is filled with wonderful spring herb stews that are practically green in color, because they have parsley and cilantro and dill and, among other green herbs.
Well, it must be wonderfully interesting for families. It's interesting. It's unfortunate in one way, because it's a time for your family to come together. So you tend to be, you know, have the same people and I would imagine the same dishes, at least for the Seders I've attended. They always, it's kind of like our Thanksgiving too. You hate to vary it too much, because everybody wants, you know, Aunt Ida's special, you know, potato dish. But how interesting would it be to take a trip around to a lot of different Seder tables and just taste the different variations of the meals that they're having and that reflect their family background and where their people came from. And I just think it would be so intriguing.
Well, even if you have to have your traditional meal, at least incorporate a few different side dishes. If you serve two main dishes, which many people do if they're having a very large Seder, have one of them be something new and exciting. And then next year, that may become your traditional dish. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful way of sort of incorporating new foods. Jewish people are very diverse people, and I think it's a great way to express that diversity, having all different foods.
So from, it's diversity, yeah. It's eating regionally, it's eating seasonally, it's eating locally, because you have to shop for it, you know, that, you know, just beforehand. So you've got it all in there. That's very good. That's interesting. There was another point that you made that I think is just so important and in your book, Jewish Holiday Cooking, and that is to the importance, as you just mentioned, to incorporate a new dish, to invent, you know, your own tradition, because the old traditions will die away. I mean, you can't keep cooking it exactly the same way. And if you incorporate new dishes and create new traditions, those that will live on, and then you're teaching your children about tradition as well.
I think that's so true, Linda, because our palates change. I don't think that I taste food the same way that my great-grandparents did. We become accustomed to eating very, very different kinds of food. I don't like chicken soup that's swimming with golden rings of fat. You know, I mean, to my ancestors, that was a sign of the good life. It isn't to me.
Yeah. When I said that you were part sleuth and part historian and traveling around for this research on this book, you, in fact, did go to Italy and France for research on some of the traditional foods. One thing in particular you mentioned was a hunt for a Passover recipe from a lost community in Provence. What was that all about?
Well, this was a community that existed in the south of France. The Jews were expelled from France at the end of the 14th century, but they were allowed to remain in the south of France under the Pope's jurisdiction in just four small communities. And according to literature by Provençal poets like Frédéric Mistral, their language was incredibly musical. They had their own liturgy. Their dishes were supposed to be superb. And I had read about one of their dishes called Le Prince. This was a Passover dish that was talked about.
Now, Le Prince,
it's P-R-I-N, and it was written about by Armand Lionel, who wrote a book called Jerusalem à Carpentras, this little town in the south of France.
Carpentras
was like a little Jerusalem. And this dish was a breast of veal that was stuffed with fistfuls of Swiss chard, spinach, fresh green herbs again, and rice. I looked for copies of this recipe in cookbooks in France, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And eventually I wound up making my own version of it. But that community was so interesting. He wrote about this little ghetto there where the Jews would make this Passover food, their matzahs, which were called kudol, and smelled so enticing that the Christians who were forbidden from eating any Jewish food by the bishop would come banging on the gates of the juiverie to beg to have this. To those of us who have eaten, you know, dry and very uninteresting matzah that has to be slathered with either olive oil or, you know, or something, butter or something to make it palatable, to think of this kudol hot from the oven being so enticing is very interesting.
I think of a lot of the crisp breads that are so popular now, and that's, you know,
well,
similar things.
Actually, you can take matzah. It's very elemental. It's just made out of flour and water, not even salt, and make it into a flatbread.
Well, and then you give the interesting, which I think many people aren't aware of, you give the interesting history of matzah and background and the law and the technique behind it that's supposed to be adhered to. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how quickly it should be made? And
yes, the whole process should take no more than 18 minutes.
18 minutes. Anyone can make matzah.
Because there is a fear that some stray yeast from the air might cause the dough to rise.
To ferment, any kind of fermentation.
Right, like a sourdough.
Right.
You had brought up international variations, and the matzah that I had in Italy was really, really fascinating. It looked like little puffed pieces of lace. It was much thicker than the traditional matzah that we're used to here and had all of these holes and cutouts, quite beautiful. And many Italian Jewish recipes call for something like a matzah lasagna. And when you think of making a lasagna out of traditional matzahs, substituting, but these thick matzahs, they would be able to soak and actually flavor and use for the layers in between the tomatoes and the cheese. It's just as if they couldn't give up their, you know, the wonderful pasta that they're used to. So they figured out a way to make it with matzah.
And you think of, I mean, eggplant parmesan is breaded eggplant. The breading actually takes the place of any pasta. And people who don't know what the dish is think they're eating eggplant and pasta with tomato sauce and cheese.
Right,
they don't
right.
realize it's just the breading. So I can see where that would be an excellent substitution.
Right.
Very good.
What's very interesting about a lot of the Passover cuisine, and, you know, so much of this is because of various restrictions that Jews had to adhere to in terms of what they were not permitted to eat. So much of the Passover cuisine has become these sort of what I think of as Jewish Hall of Famers. The matzah balls, matzah brei, these matzah fritters that are made by both Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews. Many of these flourless nut torts.
Yes.
which are and honey sponge cakes or you have these fabulous walnut cakes that contain really no flour and are perfect for gluten-free diets.
Well, and that brings me to another point that I wanted to make sure we talked about. You have a wonderful chapter on vegetarian and vegan dishes for the holidays. That and so then you just mentioned that the nut cakes, that's, you know, for gluten-free diets. What are some of, what would be like one of the more, I guess, the basic dish on a vegetarian, for a vegetarian Seder that you would recommend?
Well, for vegetarians and not vegans, it's not that difficult. Because then you can make many of these matzah-rich dishes using lots of eggs and get your protein in there. Mm-hmm. Matzah-rich dishes like kugels, you can make. There's a wonderful recipe for matzah polenta that was developed by Michael Romano of Union Square Cafe. And serve that as a main dish. Matzo balls, of course, can be made without any kind of meat product at all and can be served in vegetarian soups. The thing with vegetarian Passover food is you want to make it very, very, very flavorful. And most of the dishes that we're used to for Passover have that fifth taste, the umami. Right, which is present in meat and Parmesan cheese. Soy, which is actually forbidden to Ashkenazi Jews on Passover as well.
Oh, because of the bean. The
right, the because bean. It's... Yeah. So you have to figure out ways to caramelize foods to get the most out of the flavor so that you don't feel like you're eating the same food over and over again. Mushrooms are a wonderful thing to use. I make a wild mushroom kugel out of potatoes, or you could make a kugel using wild mushrooms and Swiss chard or something like that.
Sounds delicious. Well, your book is filled with innovative recipes as well as, I said, as well as wonderful takes on traditional recipes, and I encourage people to look at. And it's not just for Passover; it's all of the holidays. All the holidays are presented. I just chose to talk particularly about Seder since we are here when this is recorded, we are in the season of Passover. Passover is Monday; begins Monday. But you've got dishes for every holiday in here, and I encourage people if you would like to learn more about Jewish cooking to take a look at this book. It's called Jewish Holiday Cooking by Jane Cohen. Jane, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I've learned a lot from this book and from you today. Thank you very much. And thank you to our sponsor, Dixon's Farmstand Meats in Chelsea Market in New York City, as well as our producer, Jack Inslee, and engineer, Nat Wiener. Again, you've been listening to Linda Palacio on A Taste of the Past.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.